Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to Valley Writers Read, which, as you probably know by now, comes to you every Wednesday evening at this time. We've got two great stories for you tonight. The first is by Merced author Elizabeth McMung Tatanko and is entitled Military Cemetery. And the second one is by Fresno author Anne Leith Biggs, who entitles her story Leaving Rapunzel's Window. But first things first, let's listen to Gabriella Lawson reading Military Cemetery by Elizabeth McMung Tatanko. Military Cemetery.
Military Cemetery. So, tell me about you, the guy said. He had a medium build, scruffy blonde hair, and broad shoulders. Something seemed tense inside of him somehow, with the density of a bomb. I shrugged. Not much to tell, I said. I grew up here, I work here in a small publishing firm, and I like to go out to brunch. He nodded. I looked around the bar. It was a neighborhood place, but not too divey. The wallpaper was striped and purple. Wide arched doorways led off into other rooms. Pale pink candles flickered in purple glass holders on the tables. Every once in a while, a burst of sound would erupt from the room at the back where they kept all the pool tables. All in all, it was good. Stephanie flopped back down next to me, her hands holding two wine glasses. That took forever, she said, handing me one. But I could tell from the slight cadence in her voice that she and the other guy had been doing some shots. I could also tell this because I had watched them. Are you sure? She had said, and he had nodded and told her that special ladies deserved to kick back once in a while. It was obviously a line, and I tried to catch her eye, but she wasn't looking. Now all four of us were sitting at the table, huddled around our own purple candle like vagrants at a campfire. I was just saying to Shelley, started the guy who was supposed to be mine somehow. Kelly, Stephanie said, interrupting. Her name is Kelly. Kelly, then, he nodded brusquely. I was just saying to Kelly, then, that maybe we should go somewhere else in a few minutes, like the hotel where I'm staying. I saw it had hot tubs. I took a sip of wine. I did not want to go to the hot tubs. The lights dimmed noticeably, probably on a timer. Cold air wafted in methodically as if bored, and I felt goosebumps rise along the tops of my shoulders. Stephanie's guy leaned authoritatively in and arched his arm over across the back of her seat. His underarm seemed to pulse darkly with sweat against the heather gray of his shirt. He kept narrowing his eyes and squinting despite the dark. I think that's a really good idea, he said. A couple in the corner was laughing loudly. The woman was gesturing, and the man kept trying to catch her hand and hold it. He was laughing too, but losing momentum at it. Her hands fluttered too quickly like birds he might crush if he caught them, and the cadences of her laughter seemed to be circling upwards as if toward hysteria. I looked over at Stephanie, who was leaning forward, away from the guy's arm. The guy who was supposed to be mine kept staring at me. I don't want to go hot tubbing, I said. Yeah, me neither, said Stephanie, who appeared to have broken free of her guy's spell. Besides, the point of coming here was so we didn't have to drive. The guys nodded, clearly irritated. I couldn't begin to think of a better reason not to have brought a car. We'd have to walk home, and I let myself savor this idea for a few seconds. The cool of the fog-drenched night and the way the streets would shine slickly in the orange pulse from the streetlights. We all took sips of our drinks. Stephanie's guy looked over at her as if waiting for some kind of answer, but she refused to look at him. She reached forward and twirled around a coaster on the top of the table. Parkview, it said. Enjoy the experience. My guy poked my arm. Hey, he said, I need to go outside for a smoke. You want to go with me? I didn't smoke. Stephanie met my eyes and nodded, though, almost imperceptibly. She leaned back slightly into the arm of the guy she was with. I downed my wine in a gulp and nodded back. So there was something, I thought. She hadn't written this off as a loss quite yet. Outside, the fog was starting to creep back in, and there weren't any cars. The street was so empty I thought I could hear the electric buzz of the streetlights. A car horn sounded off somewhere in the distance, wrapped in fog. There was a hill to our left that was the site of a military cemetery, but most of the time I was able to ignore it, driving past on my way to the grocery store and to work without looking. The stones didn't change in the darkness. I wrapped my big parka over my shoulders and clutched it tight with my fingers. The guy lit a cigarette and took a drag. "Did you want one?" he muttered. I shook my head. "Good," he said, without making eye contact. "These things will kill me." We sat there, watching the fog. It probed and sat, leaned into corners, and backed away. It swallowed the light. He leaned back, satiated, and draped his arm over the back of the bench, leaving the cigarette to dangle precariously over the street. "When I got enlisted," he said abruptly, "it was super scary. I was only gone for a year, and my wife left me. Have you ever been married?" I shook my head no. I was 24. I couldn't imagine. He nodded. "She couldn't handle it. All the waiting. It's hard." I pulled my arms tighter against me. "Did you sign up on purpose?" I asked. "What made you go?" He took another drag. I guess I just wanted to see more of the world," he said, his eyes alert as he scanned down the street. "I was just out of high school and had never really thought about college that much. I thought I could take a few years, get some experience, and then come back with better stories." He paused, staring at the side of the silent houses across the street from the bar. "But now I think it was a stupid decision." That morning, I had been laid off from work. We had all come in just like always, and they had called everyone into the back into a meeting and given us notice. I had worked there the last 3 years while I wrote my master's thesis for grad school. I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. I held on to my elbows through the arms of my coat. "I'm sorry," I said. "That sounds hard." "So am I," he said back, pushing himself forward on the thin wood slats of the bench. He paused, his cigarette almost extinguished. "People always ask me, like, did I kill anyone?" he said thoughtfully. "And I always say no." I didn't know how to respond. No one I knew was in the military, and no one I knew had ever been killed. My parents had been high school sweethearts, and they still lived in the small house where I'd grown up. I hadn't known until embarrassingly late that meat came from animals. I felt stupid and obtuse sitting next to this man who had been through so much more. I leaned back in my seat. "I did, though," he said, staring into space. "Kill someone." He paused, as if waiting for a reaction. I murmured, "Oh," and then he went on. "I did it with a knife. It was harder than I thought it would be, getting it all the way in, and..." Someone shouted, and we both jerked our heads back to look. Three college-aged guys were walking together, carrying grocery bags, coming our direction. They turned down a corner, exploding into laughter that faded as they disappeared out of sight. I pulled my arms tighter around myself. It was quiet outside, only us and the fog from the cemetery. The slats of the bench felt cold through my jeans, and I shivered. I tried to imagine what he was telling me and couldn't. All I saw were words printed out on a page. "I did, though. Kill someone." "I'm sorry," I whispered again. He finished the cigarette, got up, and kicked the side of the bar so hard that his shoe left a black mark on the wall next to the door. Inside, a couple who had been standing nearby looked over, their faces scattered into question marks. "I shouldn't have told you that. I self-sabotage. I don't know why. I'm sorry." He threw his cigarette onto the ground and stomped it out with his foot. I watched the circular rhythm that he made with his shoe as he ground it into black marks on the cement. I nodded. I turned my head all the way around to look at him, but his eyes weren't focused. He was staring out toward another end of the street where there was a movie theater and a bowling alley and about 300 tiny, trendy restaurants. Tinny laughter twinkled out periodically like Christmas tree lights, and people walked past wearing stylish pea coats, their cheeks flushed. They never made it down here, though, to the bar by the hill. "I shouldn't have told you that," he said again. "But it's not something most people have done." His heart felt like a bird. He fluttered his hands up in front of him, up until it stopped. He stopped too then, and let his hands fall to his sides. We stared at each other, our gazes meeting at last. He was pale, and his eyes were too wide. I shrank back and then felt ashamed. It was too easy not to look. He broke his gaze first. "You want to go back in?" he asked. "I could use another drink." Stephanie and I had been talking earlier today about the bike rides our family used to take out over the trail by the reservoir. We had gone slowly, only covering a few miles before stopping for lunch. It was always in springtime, and the air would feel new, like whatever had happened was over. The air didn't feel like that here. I nodded. "Me too." I felt like a blank, like a slide projector, a thing people looked at to see something else. Stephanie and her guy were leaning toward each other now, lost in conversation. She startled when we came back. The couple in the corner was leaning forward sharply now, too, and the woman's eyes glistened with tears. Her face fallen, she looked so much older, like happiness might be its own anti-aging technique. The man was speaking quickly and softly, and he kept gesturing with his hands. "All set?" asked Stephanie's guy. "They're not going," said mine. Stephanie looked at me, and I tried to let her see what had happened, the words he had said in the cemetery and the fog coming in off the ocean, sliding and waiting and thick. But her cheeks were flushed and her lips glistened wetly, and she was leaning in tightly toward her guy. "I can go," she said flatly.
"You don't have to," said her guy.
"I want to go." "I'm not going," I said. "I'm just going to walk home."
"I'll walk you," said my guy.
"We'll walk you," said Stephanie.
"This is all too confusing," said Stephanie's guy.
Birds must sleep at night, I thought, as we walked through the streets. The world was silent except for the sound of our footsteps and the patter of everyone's nervous laughter. At the door, I turned to say goodbye to my guy.
"I'm sorry I scared you," he said, leaning forward so that his shoulders and head violated the entrance to the door.
I took a step back, avoiding his too-hot drunk flesh and the reach of his arms. I looked at his hands and saw nothing but flesh, thinly clipped fingernails and calluses from work. "Have fun," I called out, seemingly through a tunnel. "Bring Stephanie back home safely." They did. And they did have fun. Stephanie told me the next morning over coffee. My guy had shipped out in the morning. This had been his last hurrah. I didn't tell her how I had cried all night, how I'd thought about hands and fog and military cemeteries, how I had thought about all of us sitting in a dark bar reaching, watching the purple light play along faces and reach into holes. The guys never called again, and eventually I forgot their names.
Gabriella Lawson reading Military Cemetery. It's the story of two young women who have a brief but meaningful encounter with a couple of eager, sort of on-the-make young men. They're in a restaurant bar when the lead character and the fellow she's with go outside because he wants a smoke. We learn that he's in the service and he's actually killed someone and did it with a knife. "I did it with a knife," he stammers. "It was harder than I thought it would be, getting it all the way in." After a while, they walk back to her house past the military cemetery, say goodnight, and though she never sees him again, now can't even remember his name, somehow she tells us she was so upset that she cried all night. Friends, this is a story that leaves us wondering about many things. What it's like for our servicemen and women to have to kill? What goes on with folks who frequent bars a lot? What happened to all those service members who were buried in that military cemetery they passed that night? And of course, most of all, what's in store for the four young people in the story we've just listened to? Friends, though the author of this story grew up in San Francisco, she currently lives in Merced. Her fiction has appeared in Slow Trains, and some of her poetry has been published in a periodical entitled The Single Hound. Thank you, Elizabeth McMahon Tatanko, for such a salient story. We're looking forward to more of your work in the future. And now on to our second story, which is written by Fresnan Anne Leith Biggs and is entitled Leaving Rapunzel's Window. Believe me, those of you who grew up here in the valley will surely feel a familiarity with the images, feelings, and memories of Anne's story. Here she is, the author, Anne Leith Biggs, reading Leaving Rapunzel's Window.
Are you lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright summer day when I kissed you and called you sweetheart? Do the chairs in your parlor bare? Do you gaze at your doorstep and picture me there? Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?
Leaving Rapunzel's Window. The White House on Michigan Avenue, just down from Gospel Music and two blocks away from Lafayette Elementary, were the perimeters of my life for more than 12 years. I came from an orphanage in Dublin, Ireland, to that house at almost 5 and moved out when I was 19. Each winter, like clockwork, the tule fog covered the valley floor. Sycamores dropped brown, crisp leaves across the yard like beads from a necklace. It was a time when we gathered the seasoned leaves into enormous heaps with a simple swipe of a match on a winter day as they hugged the curb. Smoke swirled in circles like magic performed at a carnival. Crimson flames splashed across the skies. Our town never saw the true beauty of a winter day, but early on January mornings, I caught glimpses of crystalline icicles dangling from the eaves of the kitchen window. When the change of seasons came, petals from slow-opening yellow roses stood upright, guarded by spiky thorns. My father tended his rose garden like one does a child, with utter joy and dedication. It was this garden that was his treasured legacy that lived on years past the memory. Now, a lifetime later, I sit in my car staring at the yard. I can't find the beloved roses that once bloomed like smiling faces, only to be dug up in moments of modernization. A chipping and rotting gazebo covers a rusted barbecue. The fruit trees, once full with apple and peach blossoms, rich with the aroma of spring color, have long been shredded and replaced with patches of dirt that lay scattered about the yard like pieces of forgotten debris. I was a teenager in a time when the world around us was in absolute chaos. Everything was changing before we even had a chance to realize what was happening. But there was always one constant that continued in my fragile teenage life: the house on Michigan Avenue. Each night when my sister and I turned off the light, we listened in silence to the crickets nestling in the garden or scooting across the sidewalk. We slipped between the white cotton sheets covered with pastel chenille bedspreads and shared our teenage dreams, our broken hearts, while listening from the radio to the voices of our idols in the dark. We swayed to Elvis Presley and Paul Anka and fell asleep to Ritchie Valley. In the morning, we were brought back to the reality of neatly folded clothes sitting on top of our shared dresser. When we awoke to the start of each new day, our lives remained constant and intact, regardless of the dangers we viewed on the evening news. We knew we were safe. Clothes from Lerner's, Penny's, and Connor's lined our tiny closets along with random cashmere sweaters bought with babysitting money. A lone pair of Capizio shoes lounged in their exquisite box, and after a day's wear, my sister was careful to replace them each night, spit and polished, good as new. The garden was my father's creation, 72 rose bushes in all, each rose a name and each name a memory. If the garden was my dad's legacy, the house was my mother's. He seemed unconcerned about the notions of decoration. It was he who picked out the appliances and TVs. First it was the black and white, then the color sold as a console, and his favorite, the portable that could be taken from room to room. I never remember the house needing remodeling, new paint or lighter drapes. Paintings, pictures, and mirrors chosen by my mother hung on the same single nails from years past, adorned walls the color of churned butter. Roses from the now-deceased garden garnished the dining table for as long as they bloomed each season. Grade school pictures sat on the buffet for all visitors to see. Melmac dishes with tiny blue borders sat in contrast on the yellow tablecloth with yellow gingham curtains blowing in through the back kitchen window left open on summer nights. Nightly conversation shared at the same wooden dinette table rang through the kitchen and streamed across the patio out into the yard. Recipes handed down through my mother's family included meatloaf, tuna casserole, and my favorite, enchiladas. Each night, a specific meal was arranged around the table, including salad and vegetables and a sweet homemade dessert. Warm, spicy aromas filled the air as we talked about homework, chores, and daily interactions that had transpired throughout our day. "Okay, girls, how was your day?" Dad would start with the same question each night, after saying blessings and passing our plates around the table, filling them with her exquisite homemade cooking. We couldn't wait to be the first to share the events of our day. "I got a B on my spelling test," shouted my sister before I could even get a turn. "Well, I was called on to read aloud today. It was a poem, and I must say I did a remarkable job," I said with pride, waiting for others to congratulate me for my victory for the day. "Of course you did," my mother replied, as she immediately drew our attention away from ourselves to Dad, as she inquired into the sales and the choices his best customers were making. "The TVs are selling fast," my dad chimed in. "They like the console as a piece of furniture. The wood is so rich. I think I may have sold two today. They're coming back tomorrow to seal the deal. They might even buy a portable along with it." My father was a hard worker and wore his pride like a badge when he sat at the table demonstrating his ability to sell anything to anyone. Dinner continued as each of us briefed our day, making it far better than the actual reality. Dessert was relished in silence, especially her homemade baked apple pie or fluffy lemon cake. After dinner, while we were clearing the table, Dad settled into his chair in the living room, flipping on TV and listening to Walter Cronkite as he searched through the Fresno Bee for tidbits of news that would later generate conversation with new customers at the store. He thought it was important to impress customers who came into Montgomery Ward's with worldly knowledge, willing to chat, and then be marveled by all the new merchandise. The nightly ritual repeated itself each evening as the three of us remained in the kitchen, clearing the table, watching the sink fill with steamy hot water, and slowly, the anointed one of the week carefully lowered the Pyrex dishes into the soapy water. One of us would wash, while the other dried, and Mom slowly wiped single drops of grease that trickled from the stove, stopping just before they rounded the corner to drip onto the flowered linoleum floor. We each took turns discussing the individual moments of our day that we were too embarrassed to discuss with Dad at the table. "He likes me," my sister blurted out as she dipped the unbreakable plates and cups into the soapy water. "Why would you think that?" we could hear my mother ask routinely as she wiped away the nightly residue melting onto the white enameled stove. "He passed me a note in class today, saying he's going to call me tonight, and you can't be on the phone," she said, staring right at me. "Yes, I can. You can't tell me what to do. Mom, I can be on the phone if I want, can't I? Besides, he isn't going to call you anyway." Now, girls, Mom would say with a hint of a smile spreading across her face, come on, let's finish up so you can start your homework. Even as I stand in my own kitchen, I can hear the voices still echo in my mind, and a hint of a smile blankets my face. After years of absence filled with my own foolish independence, in my mind's eye, I could walk through the front door into the dining room of my parents' house, and even with my eyes closed, my fingers could reach the sleek edges of the magnificent buffet. This buffet became my guide, sliding my hands along the rims, then moving into the living room, touching the embroidered chair just near the ribbed grill on the floor heater. For years, warm air filled and comforted our home, even as the coldest chill hung outside the front door. In the living room, a sturdy coffee table was adorned with the likes of Family Circle, Ladies' Home Journal, and the ever-popular McCall's. Twin end tables resided at the side of each arm of the sofa and held the matching lamps that cast soft shadows around the room. On the front porch, three oval castle windows looking out to different snapshots of the yard held my dreams. Sitting on the ledge, I imagined myself Rapunzel, letting my hair drop and waiting for my shining knight to come for me. It would be a long time before he came, long after I left my castle behind. I lingered each day in a different window, waiting patiently for liberation, willing to sacrifice my all. No matter which seat I chose, hidden from the street, my secret place allowed me to observe the world I was having so much trouble understanding, a world that was so much bigger than me. Sitting in the summer moonlight on the top step of my mystic porch, Mom and I stared at the stars and alone wondered how my ambitious dreams would unfold as I had been promised in my younger years. I want to be a writer, like Emily Bronte or Sylvia Plath, I blurted out from the porch, dazed by the stars that filled the night sky. Who are they? She asked, without glancing my way, leaning against the castle wall. They were amazing, talented women who devoted their lives to writing. That is what I want to do, I said excitedly, not turning around for fear of her disapproval. Well, that's nice, she said simply, without malice. There was no point in continuing the conversation. Not because she didn't want to hear it, but because I was sure she couldn't understand why I would want such a dream. Did any mother, in any place or time, really understand the hopes and dreams of her children? The last winter my parents lived in the house on Michigan Avenue, the freeze came and withered the bottle brush planted under the bedroom window in 1959, a Mother's Day present carted across town on a bus by an anxious 10-year-old. Its green, lush leaves branched out past the flower bed. Its red spindle blooms brought bees from miles around, especially in the months just past the spring rains. I look back with regret because I never gave the only house I knew much thought until it came to stand empty. In the August sun, I was no longer free to walk up the driveway or to bask under the mulberry tree in a lawn chair. I would never again dance under the carport, sit on the front steps, or pick roses from the sacred garden. I left behind a piece of my past, and even though I couldn't get it back, I felt the need to claim a piece of it so someone would know I was there. I didn't want to relive it, but I wasn't ready to give it away as nonchalantly as discards left over at a garage sale. What was it that this house said to me after all this time? I had been away from it longer than I had lived in it. But when I pulled up to the curb, an odd sense of urgency came over me. Though I never always knew such peace when I lived there, now a strange sense of well-being descended over me like a familiar quilt. I'm a grandmother now, driving down the familiar street with my granddaughter sitting beside me as I point out memories triggered by the old neighborhood. I want her to see the ghosts in Rapunzel's window, the bees perched on the bottle brush, and the shade below the peach trees. I want my memories to carry over to her, so when I'm gone, the pieces of her past become fragments that she adds to her own life's quilt. New people have moved into the White House. They replaced the roses, tore out the apple and peach trees, and constructed a short, brown, unpainted picket fence that shuts off the front lawn from the street. The castle windows remain, and the little girl sitting on the top step looking back at me likely envisions that her dreams will someday come true. I imagine she will dream bigger and regret less than I did. One day, when no one is watching and her past is caught up to her, she will drive by and remember why it was so hard to leave Rapunzel's window.
Now the stage is bare, and I'm standing there with emptiness all around. And if he won't come back to me, then they can bring the curtain down.
Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?
That was Anne Leith Biggs reading her story, Leaving Rapunzel's Window. It's a story about the warm, pleasant, and enriching family atmosphere of growing up on Michigan Avenue right here in Fresno in the heart of the valley. Her dad worked for Montgomery Ward and cultivated beautiful roses out in their yard, while her mom cherished and decorated their house, and her loving sister proved to be a great companion. Anne remembers going to school, dinners at home, washing the dishes, and wondering which one of the two sisters was going to be able to use the phone that night to talk to a boyfriend. But most of all, she recalls sitting on the inside of one of their house's castle windows, imagining she was Rapunzel so that she could let her hair down to that shining night out there somewhere. Many years later, now a grandmother, she drives her grandkids down familiar Michigan Avenue as she points out the landmarks of her old neighborhood. And now, and I'm quoting, I want them to see the ghosts in Rapunzel's window, the bees perched on the bottle brush, and the shade below the peach tree. I want my memories to carry over to them so that when I'm gone, these pieces of my past will become fragments which can be added to their own life's quilt. Thank you, Anne Leith Biggs, for such a sensitive, caring story. Folks, we heard two stories tonight, Military Cemetery by Elizabeth McMahon Tatanko and Leaving Rapunzel's Window by Anne Leith Biggs. Both of these authors are new to our program. We thank them for their submissions and hope they'll continue to contribute more stories to Valley Writers Read in future seasons. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, two authors, Angelo Angarano and David Creighton. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.